The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience by your North Carolina Reading Service. It's the Indie Week. This issue published on March the 3rd of 2023. And it's read by John Federson. That's me. I had to look. And we'll get down to it right away. I believe we can start with a cheery, jolly piece in the Indie Week about spring. This is from the online version, IndieWeek.com. Oh, wait, it's about global warming. In late February, temps at the Raleigh-Durham International Airport hit 84 degrees, the highest reading for the month since record-keeping began in the late 1800s. Pine pollen is gilding our windshields. That's what that green stuff was. Azalea blooms are emerging from their sleep. The god-awful Bradford pear trees are stinking up the side streets. Yes, thank you, landscape architects from the metropolitan area. Meteorologists measure the seasons a bit differently to make it easier to compare weather and climate stats and trends. Astronomical spring, based on the position of the sun, doesn't arrive for another 3 weeks. Well, whatever ritual you prefer, the bottom line is it's exceptionally warm. Hot even for this time of year. In late February, temps at the Raleigh-Durham Airport hit 84, the highest reading for the month, again since they began keeping records in the late 1800s. Average spring temperatures are running 3.5 degrees warmer than in 1970. An additional 15 days are recording above normal temperatures over the same time period. Likewise, the Triangle's growing season and allergy season has lengthened by a month. Because of climate change, we now experienced 220 consecutive days above freezing. The warming trend in the Triangle is holding throughout most of North Carolina, but next week nighttime temps are forecast to dip into the 30s, which means the early bloomers could get frostbitten next week. Spring temperatures in the national trends, they have increased by 2 degrees on average across the U.S. since 1970. That's about 50 years. Over that same time period, spring is warmer in 232 U.S. locations. That's equivalent to 97% of areas where climate data is officially kept. Pollen concentrations could increase 200% with a high future rates of carbon dioxide emissions. Oh, they brought that an entertaining springtime Tweety article to an end. So we'll just leave us with that and we can dream about it. And here we go onwards. And let's go to Durham and Tomasi McDonald, the head writer for that area of the Triangle. And this is about the PLE tracker project. This summer, Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry was the target of pointed criticism in Durham Under Fire, a WRAL documentary that examined the increasing number of homicides and implied that DeBerry's office was at least partly to blame for being soft on crime. DeBerry said her office did not measure success based on the number of homicide cases successfully prosecuted, but instead looked at individual cases and whether the offenders had been held accountable. Last week, the district attorney's office made public the results of a one-year study that examined plea bargaining, how prosecutors determine pleas, along with how the process may change initial charges filed against someone and how final sentences are imposed. This final report, called Plea Bargaining in the Durham County DA's Office, is the result of a partnership between that office and the Wilson Center for Science and Justice at the Duke University Law School. During the year-long tracker project, researchers collected and analyzed information from more than 300 Superior Court cases and more than 1,800 felony and misdemeanor charges, according to a press release from the DA's office. DeBerry, in this release, stated she partnered with the Wilson Center to, quote, examine the factors that go into prosecutorial decision-making to help her office better understand how felony cases are resolved, identify disparities in those resolutions, and bring more transparency to the process. And she continued, as prosecutors, the plea process is our biggest opportunity to use our discretion to create a more equitable system. The Plea Tracker Project is an important tool for ensuring our case resolutions are equitable, consistent, and tailored to address the root causes of criminal behavior. She added, the project has already shed new light on how to achieve public safety, fairness, and justice for our Durham community. She described the plea bargaining process as a historically opaque system, one that needs greater transparency, especially when one considers that plea bargains account for the disposition of 90 to 95% of all criminal court cases nationwide. The DA noted that plea offers are not often documented, so available court data does not reflect what happened during the negotiations. Indeed, the report's introduction notes that while information about plea terms and sentences are publicly available, very little is documented about how prosecutors negotiate these offers. Moreover, the public may know what gets charged, but not the reasoning for how or why a certain plea deal was reached. And it's not just the public that's left in the dark about the process, but also other prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges, quote, are largely uninformed about prosecutorial discretion and its important influence on criminal outcomes. As a consequence, this lack of transparency in the process can create inconsistencies in how plea negotiations are handled. Faculty director at the Wilson Center, Duke Law Professor Brandon Garrett, stated in the press release that he hopes the project with the county DA's office will be a model for other offices. Quote, for years, academics and policymakers have called for meaningful data on the plea process. The leadership demonstrated by District Attorney DeBerry during this year of impactful work shows that it is feasible and valuable to track pleas. We believe that this type of plea tracking should be the national standard practice. Here are some of the findings from the 32-page report. Nearly two-thirds of all charges were dismissed by prosecutors. That's more than 1,200 of 1,800 charges. The majority of dismissals were superior court charges. That's 80%. About 1 in 10 cases, 35 of 300 cases, were plea bargained to a misdemeanor charge only. When it came to sentencing, prison and probation-only sentences were each imposed in 40% of all cases. More than half of cases with violent crime received a prison sentence, and nearly half the cases with non-violent crime received a probation-only sentence. The most common types of offenses involve dangerous drugs, larceny, and robbery, and the single most common charge was possession of a firearm by a felon in 42 cases. About 80% of the people charged with felony crimes in Durham were black. Whites accounted for about 15% and Latinx community members 5%. About three-quarters of people charged with felony crimes had a prior conviction, and 44 people with no criminal record were held in pretrial detention. In 59% of the case, there was a victim. Most of the victims were black and or female. Prosecutors communicated with victims in 85% of the cases and discussed the plea terms with them before making the initial offer in 80% of all the cases. The most commonly considered mitigating factors with a person's record, history of substance use, and age. For aggravating factors, it was the seriousness of the offense, criminal history, and a history of recidivism. Cases represented by private counsel more often received probation-only sentences, but also received longer prison sentences. Prosecutors corresponded with the defense about three-quarters of the time before making that initial offer, and 95% of the time after making the initial offer. Defense attorneys requested changes to the initial plea offer in over half the cases, and some changes were made to the initial plea offer in 83% of the cases. According to the release, the project also highlighted conditions of court-ordered supervision that were present in about three-quarters of the cases, with no contact orders, mental health stipulations, and anger management training, most common in violence crime cases. In non-violent cases, there were court-ordered substance abuse assessments and cognitive behavioral interventions. The study also found that judges, quote, appeared to play a less impactful role in these plays, in these pleas, and didn't modify the pleas in 87% of the cases. However, the release noted, in the small number of cases in which the sentence was left open, judges often added additional conditions. Esme Fox writes this next online article from Durham County. The council okays a North Durham industrial park. More than 150 acres of land in northern Durham will soon be converted into an industrial hub called Welcome Venture Park. At a February 20 City Council meeting, real estate firm Welcome Group requested the rezoning and voluntary annexation of land by the intersection of Hamlin and Old Oxford Roads. Despite concerns from residents of the nearby Bragtown community, the motions passed unanimously, ushering in a construction of 1.3 million square feet of industrial space. Currently, the 157 acres of land are mostly vacant and forested. Homes and existing businesses border the property, including a metal fabricating company and a biopharma manufacturing facility, KBI Biopharma. In the coming months, it will be revamped by the Welcome Group, which is a Houston-based land development company that primarily owns properties in the southeast. Patrick Biker, an attorney representing the developer, shared an environmental remediation plan in store for Welcome Venture Park. The land was deemed a brownfield site in 2021 after a neighboring Mitsubishi semiconductor facility spilled volatile organic compounds and after chlorinated solvents were released at the nearby Beckman-Durham-Sandifer State Hazardous Waste Site. At this meeting, some Durham residents expressed concerns that the industrial park would fail to meet the needs of the community, potentially driving up the cost of living nearby. Vanessa Evans, a resident and chair of the Bragtown Community Association, that's a historically black and working class neighborhood near the site, "If you're a leading company, lead this community something better than where we are now," she said. After 14 meetings with neighbors over the course of 13 months, Welcome Group committed to fulfilling several requests from the community. This included creating an evergreen shrub buffer to separate residents who live adjacent to this development and banning several types of commercial enterprises, including gas stations and drive-through restaurants. Welcome Group will also supply $30,000 to Durham Technical Community College as a scholarship fund for local residents to learn a construction trade. Biker, the attorney, said, "To my knowledge, this is $30,000 more in scholarships than any other business park in Durham ever has proffered to benefit the community." Welcome Group decided to create this scholarship after hearing concerns from community members that, that then the Durham Planning Commission that potential high-paying jobs at the new business park would exclude local residents. Evans, who asked Welcome Group to establish a long-lasting endowment rather than a temporary scholarship, "We don't just want a one-time drop in the bucket and then leave." Evans emphasized that $30,000 would only serve 20 students. "We're hoping that this is going to be something that can be a tremendous change, not just for Bragtown, for all of Durham." Evans and other nearby residents had requested $200,000 in funds instead, but Biker said that was beyond what the developer could provide, citing construction costs such as water and sewer infrastructure and parking. The lead developer on the project, Ted Karamburas, said Welcome Group hopes to break ground sometime this year. It's unclear which corporations will set up offices in the industrial park. Continuing online, Lisa Sorg wrote this. In a split decision, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling that North Carolina's ag-gag law is unconstitutional and infringes on free speech. A three-judge panel ruled 2-1. Justices Henry Floyd and Albert Diaz, both appointed by President Obama, wrote for the majority. Judge Alison Jones, Rushing, an appointee of Trump, issued a dissent. At issue was the Property Protection Act, passed by the North Carolina General Assembly back in 2015. It allowed courts to assess civil fines on employees who took videos or photos, or even took handwritten notes, of a business's non-public areas to document alleged wrongdoing and then pass that information to anyone besides the employer or law enforcement. The fines were hefty, $5,000 per day plus attorney's fees. While the supporters of the bill argued it protected businesses from the theft of trade secrets, its underlying intent was to thwart animal rights activists from getting hired at farms and research labs and then conducting undercover investigations. Then Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican, vetoed the bill because he believed it would discourage employees, such as those working in nursing homes, from reporting illegal activities. Lawmakers overrode the veto. Well, there were multiple plaintiffs who sued the state over the measure. The ASPCA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, United Farm Workers, and Food and Water Watch. In addition to the state of North Carolina and UNC Chapel Hill, the Farm Bureau Federation of North Carolina intervened to defend the ag-gag law. UNC was a defendant because it operates animal research labs. Yesterday's appellate court ruling upheld the heart of a district court decision that determined the law as it applies to news gathering ran afoul of the First Amendment. Food and Water Watch Factory Farm Organizing Director Chrissy Kasserman, based in North Carolina, said, "This decision is a remarkable victory for transparency and democracy. Advocating for a more just and sustainable food system requires shedding light on the abuses that happen behind closed factory farm doors. North Carolina's attempt to criminalize the publishing of valuable information was nothing more than an attempt to silence critics of factory farms. Thankfully, the Fourth Circuit has protected the rights of investigators, whistleblowers, and journalists to share information with the public." The state had argued that undercover investigations in non-public areas were not protected by the First Amendment. The appellate court majority disagreed. Justice Floyd wrote, "That is a dangerous proposition that would wipe the Constitution's most treasured protections." The court found that not only was the distribution of the undercover material constitutionally protected, but so was the very act of documenting and creating the material. The state had also argued the law didn't punish speech, but disloyalty. The undercover recordings merely provided one way to prove that disloyalty. The court disagreed. The First Amendment cannot so easily be evaded. Secondly, the court lambasted the gag law over the type of speech that would be penalized. Only recordings and images that were critical of the employer were off limits. The law wouldn't apply to those that were complimentary. That strikes at the heart of the First Amendment. With few exceptions, the best known example is yelling fire in a crowded movie theater, the government can't discriminate based on the content of the speech. Justice Floyd wrote, the First Amendment's shield falls away only from those narrow categories for which the Constitution never intended protection, not from those that the legislative majority just prefers not to protect. Nor have the court ever exempted speech from the First Amendment merely because of its location, like a workplace. And there is a distinction between private and government restrictions. A private landowner, for example, can forbid people from gathering on their land to exercise their First Amendment rights. While the government could cite the people for trespassing, it cannot jail them for their speech. Floyd wrote, the First Amendment limits the government. The government does not limit the First Amendment. There's also collateral damage in the state's gag law. It would also punish anyone who encouraged someone to conduct or participate in an undercover investigation. If the state legislature was genuinely concerned in protecting private property, as alleged, then it needed to prove that it used existing laws or less intrusive tools to achieve that goal. Justice Floyd wrote, North Carolina concedes the state produced no such evidence. For the dissent, Justice Rushing argued the gag law appropriately forbids trespassing. Rushing wrote, the act of trespassing interferes with the ownership or possession of real property. Nor is the act of recording by itself protected speech. The majority opinion did not distinguish between recording in public spaces and on private property, Rushing wrote. Stealing documents or private wiretapping, for instance, is not constitutionally protected. Rushing wrote, laws can prohibit using information to harm another person or breach an obligation without raising any First Amendment concerns, Rushing wrote. The state attorney general's office said it is reviewing the decision. This North Carolina measure is modeled on legislation, the Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act, drafted in 2003 by the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC has been widely derided as a bill mill and is funded largely by the conservative Koch brothers and major corporations like ExxonMobil, Pfizer, and Anheuser-Busch. North Carolina's law is similar to measures passed by state legislatures in Kansas, Iowa, Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. The courts have struck those down, ruling they are unconstitutional. To the print edition now in rustling paper. There's some of it now. From Durham, Lena Geller has written Durham's SCAD, Good or Bad? If you haven't heard of the 87-page text amendment proposal the Durham City Council will vote on this month, a proposal that, if approved, will have a colossal impact on the city's future housing landscape, some might argue that you haven't been paying attention. Others would say you've intentionally been left in the dark. The proposal, Simplifying Codes for More Affordable Development, SCAD, is the largest privately initiated text amendment the city has received in at least two decades, if not the largest of all time, according to eight people who have spent years tracking and advising on such proposals in Durham. SCAD proposes a series of sweeping changes to Durham's Unified Development Ordinance, that's the UDO, a document that spells out local regulations for zoning and land development. Most notably, SCAD's proponents say, By loosening building and zoning regulations, SCAD would uplift small local developers and deliver vastly more units of affordable housing. Opponents say that by enabling developers to circumvent many of the standards, review mechanisms, and community engagement processes typically involved in equitable development and planning, SCAD will open the floodgates for development to occur in ways that accelerate gentrification and displacement. Tom Miller, a former Durham Planning Commissioner who spent three decades working as legal counsel for the NC Real Estate Commission, says it uses attractive language like affordable housing that are platonic goods on their own to mask a whole host of changes that have nothing to do with affordable housing. Unless, of course, you buy into the trickle-down theory that if we let developers build more housing, it will all be cheaper. Last May, two applicants, Jim Anthony, who helms a Raleigh-based development firm APG Capital, and Habitat for Humanity of Durham, the local branch of a global nonprofit housing organization, submitted the original amendment. It has since undergone several revisions. Members of Durham's Planning Department, City Council Planning Commission, and Joint City Council Planning Committee, that's the JCCPC, have weighed in on SCAD's numerous drafts, as have the community members who have attended the applicant team's public and private presentations. While Anthony and Durham Habitat are the primary SCAD applicants, neither had a direct hand in penning the text. Instead, a team of local practitioners whom Anthony hired and declined to identify took that on. Anthony and the writer team declined Indy's interview request and wouldn't answer specific questions related to community concerns, but wrote in a statement that SCAD's content includes, quote, new programs for creating affordable housing while leaving existing programs intact, as well as new paths specifically for small-scale commercial buildings, allowing local entrepreneurs small spaces from which to launch or grow their businesses. A spokesperson for Durham Habitat wrote in a statement of the Indy that the organization is, quote, the primary provider of affordable home ownership opportunities in Durham, building and selling around 25 houses a year. This spokesperson wrote, the tight land market combined with inflexible zoning threatens this important work. SCAD gives us a path to continue building homes and changing lives. When Indy asked if the organization supports all of SCAD's provision, the spokesperson wrote Habitat broadly supports the proposal's goal, but would prefer not to comment on specific provisions. The organization has played an advisory role in the proposal, according to the spokesperson. In the original SCAD application, Durham Habitat wrote that it supports four specific elements, including parking requirement and the allowance of residential construction in non-residential areas. Well, the Durham City Council will cast votes on the proposal after a public hearing at its March 20th meeting. The Board of County Commissioners will also vote on SCAD this month, but its decision, which will determine whether the amendment's provisions apply to unincorporated areas of Durham County, is less consequential than the council. In December, the Planning Commission, a body that reviews, recommends, and sometimes initiates plans and policy changes, but does not have a final say in approving, voted against approving SCAD, with some commissioners raising concerns about the proposal's intentions, scale, timing, consequences, and community engagement process. Commissioner Sarah Chagaris wrote in an advisory comment, this proposal contained no system of checks and balances to ensure affordable housing programs like Habitat would be the main beneficiary and not large developers. in staff reports and in emails obtained via a public record request, planning department staff highlighted similar issues and urged the applicant team to revise SCAD in a way that better prioritizes community interest. Now, the planning department did not respond to requests for comments for this story. While the proposal is being continuously tweaked, the November and January drafts of SCAD that the Indy used for reference during 2 months of reporting still contain many provisions that planning commissioners, staff, and community members have contested, such as offering incentives for developers to create affordable housing, while only requiring the housing to remain affordable for 5 years, and allowing certain residential uses within industrial zoning districts. Some planning commissioners do support SCAD, such as Gary Cutright, who advised the City Council in a written memo, SCAD doesn't make the UDO perfect, but pushes Durham toward a more efficient use of land. Cutright wrote, while some of his colleagues' concerns are valid, we should not throw out the proverbial baby with the bathwater. In a phone call with Indy, Cutright highlights provisions that would eliminate parking minimums and reduce regulations around accessory dwelling units as particularly appealing. Quote, we'll have a little more density in areas that today prevent that density from having. You'll have neighborhoods that are a little more walkable. Like Cutright, who owns a commercial real estate firm, planning commissioners and members of the public who voted or spoke in favor of SCAD at the Planning Commission's December meeting are primarily real estate and development professionals. Developers, realtors, business builders, and civil engineers are clearly stakeholders, and SCAD will open doors for them. Their praise as experienced industry workers speaks to the efficacy of that intention. But many with the expertise to comprehend and comment on the proposal also have a level of self-interest. SCAD is meant to open doors for people who need affordable housing too. So, how do city leaders get real community engagement for an amendment of this breadth? And why are developers afforded the opportunity to not just advise on, but rewrite the ordinance that regulates their work and correspondingly their profits? In Durham, city and county governing boards, the Planning Commission, or the Planning Department typically initiate text amendments to the UDO. But private entities, such as in this case, can submit them for review and potential approval for a $4,000 application fee. For lengthier proposals, it's not uncommon for an applicant to hire practitioners to write and revise the text. Motivation to change the UDO, coupled with financial barriers to entry, means that nearly all privately initiated text amendments come from developers, according to former and current planning commissioners. Nate Baker, an urban planner who serves on the Planning Commission, says that many developer-led proposals are limited to requests for small tweaks that would help their companies do business. He says, for example, Top Golf came, and they wanted to change some provisions about lighting in the middle of the night. SCAD's unprecedented length, though, speaks to a troublesome and atypical everything-but-the-kitchen-sink approach, wherein the applicants seek an undue amount of influence on the ordinance that regulates their companies, according to Baker. Several SCAD critics who spoke with Indy equate Durham's allowance of privately initiated text amendments to letting the fox in the henhouse. Wendy Jacobs, who serves as vice chair of Durham's Board of County Commissioners, says it creates a huge equity issue, especially with something like this proposal, which is unprecedented in size. It circumvents the government process and the public process. Others argue there are adequate checks and balances for private proposals. Cutright says developers can't write their own regulations without being voted on and approved. They can propose things just like anyone, Any member of the community can do this. Durham City Council member Javier Caballero seconds this, adding, the fox in the henhouse metaphor speaks to the public's tendency to hold developers, architects, and builders to a different standard than workers in other industry. Somehow, she says, that we have decided that their opinion on the thing they're trained to do is invalid against our opinion. Teachers shouldn't have input into education. Doctors shouldn't have input into medicine. Mechanics shouldn't have input into the automotive industry. Baker emphasizes that while the development industry's input is valuable, the text amendment process could have better safeguards to prevent abuse and heighten accessibility. For example, the city could get rid of the application fee. Since an existing UDO provision is what enables privately initiated amendments, the language could be tweaked in a way that limits the scale of developer-initiated proposals, requires signatures from applicants, or gets rid of the application fee. Or Durham could just do away with private proposals altogether. Baker says, there are quite a few communities that have either long not allowed for private applications or are eliminating that procedure. Morrisville, for example, doesn't allow them. Wake Forest requires consent from property residents who could experience impact from a privately initiated development. Baker also notes that developer-initiated text amendments often seem to move more quickly than proposals that come from the planning department or commission. He says 3 years ago, several planning commissioners formed a committee to identify the most glaring discrepancies between the regulations in Durham's UDO and the goals laid out in its comprehensive plan for growth and development. After formulating a list of requested changes, the committee submitted a text amendment to ask for the lowest hanging fruit, maximum block regulations, which are often used to improve connectivity in communities. Baker says the process had taken so long that we gave up on all the other items in the list. Much of the public discourse around SCAD, particularly online, relates to the character of the applicant Anthony. A wealthy developer, he's prominent in local GOP circles and has donated thousands of dollars to right-wing politicians. Madison Cawthorn, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Jesse Helms, to name a few, whose politics harm the communities Anthony says SCAD will benefit. On his personal social media accounts, Anthony has repeatedly posted transphobic remarks and voiced support for January 6th insurrectionists. This paper trail has elicited the expected pushback from residents of a staunchly progressive city like Durham, but it also highlights the complexity of the proposal at hand. For those looking to drum up resistance to SCAD, publicizing screenshots of Facebook posts and campaign finance reports may seem more efficient than writing explanations of the proposal's provisions. Still, a handful of people have taken the latter approach. Over the past month, a group of 8 community members with varying backgrounds in planning, tenant advocacy, environmental justice, and real estate law have met on Zoom every few days, for hours at a time, to comb through SCAD line by line. All 8 are neighborhood delegates to the Inter-Neighborhood Council of Durham, a coalition of communities and homeowners associations across the city and county. And it lists this line-by-line team. Benita Green of Merrick Moore, Stephen Knill of Leesville Road Coalition, Donna Frederick, Bragtown, Sherry Rosenthal, Watts Hillendale, Mimi Kessler, Trinity Park, Tom Miller, Watts Hillendale, Vanessa Evans, Bragtown, Richard Ziegler, Birch Avenue. The line-by-line team's primary concerns center around SCAD's proposed Progressing Affordably Toward Housing PATH program, which offers residential density and height bonuses, as well as setback relief for projects where 25% of rental units are affordable at 60% of the area median income, or where 25% of for sale units are affordable at 80% of AMI. For projects with 25% or more affordable units, developers would receive considerable relief from regulatory compliance. And for projects like Habitats with 100% affordable units, regulation would be further relaxed, with SCAD removing all dimensional requirements and density restrictions. After taking these incentives, though, developers would only have to keep their rental units affordable for 5 years. For sale units would have no cap on affordability beyond the initial sale. Durham already has an affordable housing density bonus with a 30-year cap on affordability. While the existing bonus is rarely used, several planning commissioners tell the Indy it could easily be tweaked to be more appealing. Miller, a member of the line-by-line team, calls the PATH program the fig leaf for the entire text amendment. 5 years is a trivial shelf life for affordability, he says, and the text does not account for situations that are bound to arise. For example, if a developer sells a property during the 5-year affordability period, is the new proprietor bound to the same timeline? The PATH program would also lead to a downgrade in the quality of affordable units, according to the line-by-line team. Miller says, historically, when developers take any kind of affordable housing bonus, they've been required to make the affordable units indistinguishable from market units. If SCAD is adopted, the affordable units can be smaller. They can be accessory dwelling units, and the market units can all be primary. While one SCAD provision would allow ADUs to be larger, up to 1,200 square feet and 2 stories tall, as long as units are not larger than the primary structure versus the current cap at 800 square feet and 1 story, Miller says this tweak would come with its own issues. By allowing ADUs bigger, their virtue as a source of relatively affordable housing would be lost, particularly given SCAD contains no affordability requirements for ADUs. SCAD would also allow ADUs to occupy large areas on the grounds as places of worship. Up to 75% of grounds in downtown and urban tiers, Miller wrote in a note to the Planning Commission, under the definition, that could be a small building with a concrete seahorse named the Universal Temple of Neptune. For many SCAD proponents, though, loosening regulations around ADUs is a key to broadening Durham's affordable housing option. Topher Thomas is a high school theology teacher and tiny house developer who serves as volunteer advisor to SCAD's writers. His affordable housing company, Coram Houses, would thrive under some of the provisions that SCAD proposes, he says. There's a small lot I'm working on right now, he says. With the current code, by right, I could build 3 ADUs. And if I wanted to sell them and give somebody a home ownership opportunity, I would only be able to sell all 3 to the same buyer, and that would not be affordable. With SCAD's changes, though, Thomas said he would be able to build more and larger tiny houses on the lot and sell each for around $125,000 apiece. Quote, the changes in ADU size requirements are really exciting. If we can do 1,200 square feet, we could have a 3-bed, 2-bath. You're talking about a family of 5 actually having access to housing at an affordable rate. He acknowledges that relaxing regulations around ADUs will invite some developers to scam the system. The ways that we put guardrails around that are important, but whether we have that figured out or not, not having more flexible regs as an option is troubling. What a quote. Unless the team drastically alters SCAD in its next 20 days, critics say the city council will vote on a proposal whose applicants have not figured out those guardrails on ADU developments and otherwise. Miller says small developers are not shaping the built environment. But in order to get advantages to offset the impact of a dramatically rising land market, they're proposing rule changes for everybody. Proponents and critics do seem to see eye to eye on some SCAD provisions. Several officials who broadly support SCAD have called one proposed change that would allow certain residential uses within industrial districts a non-starter. At the Planning Commission's December meeting, for example, Vice Chair Kimberly Cameron voted yes on SCAD, but noted that allowing residential development in industrial areas has, quote, a very storied history of racial segregation and raises environmental justice issues. Another provision, which would eliminate parking minimums for new developments, has received support across the board as a way to improve Durham's walkability. But taken in tandem with some of SCAD's other proposed changes, like removing buffer requirements in certain areas, even this tweak would be complicated in practice, according to Miller, who says the amendment's lack of clarity and regulatory commands would lead to various unintended consequences. Miller, I'm better positioned than most people, and I admit that I have difficulty keeping up. And if I have difficulty keeping up, what about the majority of the people who have to live with these decisions? Besides a handful of Planning Commission and JCCPC meetings, the public has had two formal opportunities to view the SCAD team's presentation on its proposal and ask questions. Both teams took place last year at the St. James Family Life Center on West Club Boulevard. Regina Mays, a mental health coach and longtime advocate for equitable development, describes the St. James presentation she attended as informative, but was discouraged by the homogeneity of the crowd, which, she says, mainly comprised development industry figures and vigilant activists. Quote, the lives that will be affected by these proposed changes did not have equal representation in the room. For the handful of lay people in attendance, Mays says the presentation's rhetoric came across as exclusionary. Quote, a few years ago, it used to be a space and time where you would hear developers say, we don't want to rewrite history. We want to learn from our mistakes. But I don't hear that anymore. I hear more of the language of this is going to happen anyway, and you can either be part of the process or not. I hear a lot of times they say residents are not coming to the meetings, and, well, could they find the meeting? According to city emails and documents the Indy obtained, SCAD's applicant team relied solely on the planning department's outreach platforms and newsletters to publicize the two open meetings in St. James, and specifically requested there not be an option for citizens to join via Zoom. As far as other community efforts, the SCAD team has engaged five churches in a design charrette related to mission-based housing and delivered private presentations to more than 30 groups, including local civic organizations, nonprofits, educational institutions, and industry practitioners. In an August staff report, planning staff wrote, quote, a majority of the identified groups appear to be development affiliated. Soon after, one staff member emailed SCAD's applicant team with a plea, quote, spend the time with impacted community members, especially historically marginalized, underrepresented, low-wealth, LGBTQIA, the disability community, and rural communities, among others, noting that, quote, the reporting requirement for affordable housing is not more of a burden than the ability for low-wealth community members to attain and regain housing. INC President Bonita Green, also a member of this line-by-line team, invited the SCAD team to present its proposal to the Inc. after she attended one of the meetings at St. James. She says there were a lot of things in their proposal that were troubling. Since Inc. has such a broad reach across the city and county, we thought it would be a good platform to hear for people to hear and ask questions. The SCAD applicant team agreed, but things didn't go well during the presentation, which Green describes as an overly simplified slideshow, nor the Q&A session that ensued. Green: someone asked a question about gentrification. Anthony's response was gentrification was necessary. I could see the shock on people's faces. At the end of the meeting, I revisited the question, and that's when he leaned in and said, gentrification is necessary to weed out crime and push out the undesirable. So he was very clear on that. Donna Frederick, a community advocate and line-by-line member who owned and operated Durham's now-closed Playhouse Toy Store before retiring, attended both SCAD presentations at the St. James. Frederick echoes both May's sentiments on lack of representation and Green's remarks on the reductiveness, but adds that even if SCAD's applicant team were checking those boxes, there would still be issues with the sequence of the larger process. Quote, it's backwards. It's like the product comes first, then the community. What really would have made sense if the developers were asking, what would you like to see improved about building in Durham from a layperson's view, and then writing a proposal based around the input. That was not done here. One of the things most stakeholders agree on is that Durham's UDO, last comprehensively updated in 2006, is in dire need of a rewrite. In fact, planning staffers are slated to conduct a substantial rewrite later this year after the city puts the finishing touches on its new comprehensive plan, a long-range vision rooted in a robust community engagement process that lays out future goals for growth and development in Durham. The plan is used to guide subsequent updates to the UDO, and its upcoming iteration has been in the works for more than 5 years. The notion of adopting SCAD within the month then raises some timing questions. Jacobs says, to move forward with this 87-page, very impactful text amendment before the comp plan is adopted is inappropriate. I would request that only the portions of the text amendment that are in conformity with the proposed comp plan should move forward. In a document, the SCAD team outlines 22 ways in which its proposal aligns with the new plan, comprehensive plan, including, quote, SCAD is going through the approved process for text amendment, making sure to go above and beyond when it comes to community engagement meetings and listening to the citizens of Durham. Planning department staff too named SCAD's timing as a concern, stating in an August report, quote, enacting far-reaching zoning changes in advance of a new UDO may be viewed through one of two perspectives, as premature or as an opportunity to test out the effectiveness of these ideas before they are incorporated into the new ordinance. Councilwoman Caballero takes the latter perspective. That's the beauty of it, she says. It's like, let's do it. And if we don't like it, if it's bad in 3 years, you just say, no, we can't let them do it. Caballero, along with City Council member Leonardo Williams and Jillian Johnson, all expressed strong support for SCAD in their conversations with Indy, but said their votes will hinge on the provisions in the final draft. Mayor and other council members did not respond to Indy's request for comment. While the scheduled UDO rewrite could indeed fix some of the issues SCAD seeks to remedy, critics argue that planning staff shouldn't have to spend time engaging in a retroactive runaround. Baker says that if SCAD is passed, its ramifications would come not only from its provisions, but from the message that approving it would send. Baker, right now, we're even putting aside the comprehensive plan and delaying it so that we can bring developer-initiated amendments forward. This chaotic environment empowers developers who have the time, resources, and the understanding of how all the moving pieces work. It empowers them to set the agenda. All right, in my brief remaining time, I believe I have time for a music review by Jordan Lawrence, which reviews Sumner James's new release, I Could Just Go On Forever, which was released in end of January. If the notion of a member of a local indie pop band named after a character from Lord of the Rings releasing homemade electronic records on a side doesn't fill you with overwhelming confidence, I totally get it. Long is the list of tedious side projects for musicians who would be better suited to dedicating effort toward their main band. But James Phillips Sumner James is not such a project. Over the years, James and steadfast Bombadil member Daniel Michalek have stuck together in the winningly quirky and deep-thinking Durham band, keeping the project above water during multiple obstacles, including lineup shifts and a period when a nerve condition sidelined Michalek. But James has also spent the past decade-plus in solo work, cutting his teeth on charming electro-pop before moving into a succession of increasingly engrossing ambient records. Now you're talking my language. I Could Just Go On Forever, Phillips' third ambient album, the first release for Bathysphere Records as a new imprint he's starting, is a testament to what Phillips has become during his time releasing music as Sumner James. A seasoned electronic musician with his composer's touch for harmony and melody, Phillips does not just layer up vistas of arresting, trance-inducing sonic texture. He lets melodies emerge and play out across the various elements. Tunes flit from skittering clicks to airy synths in the way an orchestra might toss from violin to viola, with other themes emerging in the background, giving his music uncommon richness and depth. The album spans various shades of bittersweet calm, from the apocalyptic chill of Rainy Friday and the digitized ennui of the title track and Hard Drive Detritus, to the expansive yearning of a 14-minute epic, Just the World, lulling the listener into its reverie and then wowing with the emotion-rich intricacy of each track's construction. In other words, it sounds like the work of a fully realized project operating at its highest level. Maybe, after all, we should call Phillips an electronic musician who also has a band. So Jordan Lawrence has given this review, I Could Just Go On Together, 4 stars. That's their highest level of approval from Indie Week, which, by the way, is my last article that I have time to read tonight. All right, John Feddersen bidding you farewell for Indie Week for this issue. I'll be back next week. No, I won't. Somebody else will be reading this issue. I'll be on the road with important international assignments. And so, for the North Carolina Reading Service, Indie Week bids you farewell.